Welcome to Tape 2 of Conscious Aging with Ramdas. In this session, Ramdas explores the great mystery of death. He addresses such questions as, what is the experience of dying like? How do we grieve when those we love die? And how do we approach our own dying with acceptance and grace? And now, recorded live at the Conscious Aging Conference in New York City, Facing Death with Ramdas.
Good morning. For some of you, coming to this morning session is a lark, and for some of you, it's a little threatening and frightening. And I recognize all of that, and I appreciate that we all realize that part of our agenda as people of any age is to find some way of being with the idea of death and I know that's why you are here. There's a tombstone inscription that I think many of you have heard. Dear friend, please know as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you will be. Prepare yourself to follow me. And we are preparing ourselves. I realize it's very presumptuous to get up and talk about death as if I know. But I have a lot of chutzpah. That's Sanskrit for... And something has happened to me as a result of my meanderings through the realms of consciousness over the past 30 years that has changed my attitudes towards death. And a lot of the fear that death generated that led to denial has gone from me. And I'm one of the strange people that absolutely delights and enjoys being with people as they're dying. In fact, it is as such incredible grace for me that in the morning when I know I'm going to be with such a person, I get absolutely thrilled in my body, in my being. Because I know I'm going to have an opportunity to be in the presence of truth. So I would like to share with you this perspective and stories and images and talk for maybe half of our time and then work with questions and answers. We are living at a time where birth has come out of the closet in the past 20, 30, 40 years, and death is just beginning to come out of the closet. It is now beginning to be acceptable to consider the possibility that people actually die. Usually in our culture, it has been put behind doors, behind sheets, behind, you don't talk to the children about it, you don't show anybody. And for me, who has grown up in that culture, it was quite an experience when I started to live in India, where when somebody dies, they are put on a pallet and wrapped in a silk sheet or a sheet, and then carried through the streets to the burning grounds. And the with satya hai, satya ha, with the a mantra being recited as they go through the streets. And the death is public for everybody to see. The body is right there. It's not in a box. It's not hidden. And because India is a place of the extended family and very few and inadequate hospitals, most people are dying at home, so that most people, as they grow up, have been in the presence of someone dying. While in our culture, an amazing number of people, even at middle age, have never been in the presence of someone dying. They have walked away from it and hidden from it. And I was one of them, and I have certainly changed in the past 25 years. I think the reason that I changed was that and I know this will offend some of you, but it's truth is always difficult. That through my experiences with psychedelic chemicals, particularly originally the mushrooms of Mexico, which were used by curanderos and oracles in Mexican religions, and the mushrooms have been used throughout religious history, actually, for mystical experiences. Through that experience, first experience, I came in contact with a part of my being that as an adult, I was not, I had not identified with, I had not acknowledged. And it was a part of my being that lay behind my social roles, behind my personality. And it was indeed a part of my being that didn't seem to have much to do with birth and death. It could be called soul or awareness or spirit or God or whatever. And for me, who was a Western social psychologist, professor at Harvard, materialist, philosophical materialist, that experience was an extremely confusing one. Because there was nothing in my armamentarium of scientific methodology or in psychology that prepared me to deal with that component of my being. And once I experienced that being, it started to profoundly change the nature of my life after that, of who I thought I was. Because up until then, I had identified with that which dies. And as long as you identify with that which dies, there is always fear of death, because it's the fear of cessation of existence. And I realize now that although I didn't know the form that it would take after death, I knew that what there was about something about the essence of my awareness was outside of death. Now, the interesting thing for me at that time was that when I had that experience, it was what I called ineffable, indescribable, because I had no concepts to deal with what I was finding in my being. And probably had I been more emotionally connected to my Jewish roots, I would have found in the Kabbalah and in all of the Book of Brilliance and so on, I would have found metaphors and analogies for what I experienced. But I wasn't. And the book that came to my attention, that was brought to my attention by Aldous Huxley, who was part of our project and visiting at MIT that year, was a book called The Tibetan Book of the Dead. And what happened to me when I read The Tibetan Book of the Dead was I was reading descriptions of the direct experiences I was having with the mushrooms. Now, this was very confusing to me, again, because this book was 2,500 years old. I thought I was at the leading edge of the unknown. And here was a very ancient text, a book that was used by monks, by lamas, read to fellow lamas at the point they were dying and for the days following their death, whispered in their ear, about the process of dying. Out of that, my colleague Timothy Leary and my other colleague Ralph Metzner and I began to see the Tibetan Book of the Dead in metaphorical terms as a story of psychological death and rebirth, even though it was used as physical death and rebirth. And so we did a book called The Psychedelic Experience, which was a manual based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead for going through this psychological death rebirth. And I really think that although it has been made trivial in a way, the idea that's a biblical, the idea of dying and being born into truth or wisdom or spirit is really what our business is that we're talking about when we deal with death. And that as you have extricated yourself from a solid identification with body and with personality and with materiality, you begin to have spaciousness to allow for the possibility that death may be part of process rather than end. And I think I feel that very deeply. People say, do you believe that there is continuity after death? And I say, I don't believe it, it is, which offends my scientific friends no end. But belief is something you hold with your intellect, and this has gone way beyond that now. So you may be just sharing my total pathology. I have no idea, and that it's up to your intuition to decide that. I would never know if I was completely crazy, so. To show you how crazy I am, I have a friend who some of you have met through books, a friend named Emmanuel. Emmanuel is a spook, a being that has dropped his body somewhere along the way and speaks through a lovely woman named Pat Rodegast. And I must point out to you when I'm talking about channeled beings that all beings that don't have bodies aren't wise. That there are as many schlock people without bodies as there are with them, and there are a lot of well-meaning beings who've left their bodies and want to send back messages like buy United States Steel, and they don't know any more than they knew before. So you have to be very discriminating when dealing with disembodied beings in the same way as you are with embodied beings. But Emmanuel has a lot of nachas. He has a lot of real wisdom, and he's like an uncle to me. He's just wonderful fun. And when I said to Emmanuel, I deal a lot with the fear of dying in this culture and death. What should I tell people? And he said, Ram Dass, tell them that death is absolutely safe. Now just put those two things together and realize what a far out line that is. Death is absolutely safe. And then he added one more image. He said, it's like taking off a tight shoe. Okay, can you hear that one? Like taking off a tight shoe. Now just imagine that you as spirit or awareness have contained yourself in an incarnation, or contained it in a conceptual model of who you are and on a storyline. And then at some point, you dissolve out of that, you break out of that, and there is this incredible release quality. Well, these kinds of things I'm talking about are very different from the way in which our culture is presently treating death. Presently, we see death as an enemy. The medical profession sees death as a failure. The temple of life is the intensive care unit. The medical person is the priest. And when that became unacceptable, we then moved towards the hospice movement. Now, the hospice movement is extremely useful in coming back to a psychologically supportive environment, because intensive care units don't allow babies, they don't allow dogs, they don't allow flowers, they don't allow the human connections that give you psychological support. And the hospice movement was very interested in providing psychological support. And as such, it has played a useful role. And it provides a warm setting either in the home or in a hospice residential space for people to have psychological support and respect and dignity as a human, as a personality, while they are dying. I want to support hospice and at the same moment express my reservations, because hospice, in order to be fully acceptable into the economic structures of the society, meaning Medicare and so on, has avoided the spiritual aspects. And it has done so quite intentionally, actually. And I find that Cecily Saunders, who started the hospice movement, who I think is a very caring human being, still says death is an outrage. And I personally don't experience that. So that I want to support the hospice movement as a step in the right direction, but I want to say that we have a lot further to go in terms of what our possibilities are for creating environments for people as they're dying, where they can have the spaciousness to explore the process they're going through without being surrounded by people who feel sorry for where they are. Because and what I have tried to do with Stephen Levine and his wife Andrea and Dale Borglum, a number of people, is over the years create a space. We've had different programs like Dial a Death, where you can call up and talk to people and have pillow talk with people to share with them the process of staying conscious through dying. We've had the Dying Center. We had one in New Mexico. My model was, was that I knew that my being with people that were dying, here's my predicament. I'm incarnated, and I have all of the stuff that goes with an incarnation. The deepest one is what's called first chakra, for those of you in those systems, understanding those systems, which is the fear of survival. It's preoccupation with survival. And I know that if I am going to work on myself spiritually in this lifetime, one of the things I want to do is work with my fear of death. And the way I can do that is by being around death during my lifetime. In the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, for example, they send the monks out to the cemeteries to spend the nights in the cemeteries. And in the tradition, they throw the bodies out there uncovered for the birds to eat it. So the whole thing is ecologically sound. And so you go out there and you sit with the bloated corpse, the fly-infested corpse, the skeleton, and you get a chance to be aware of all the process of nature. And you watch your own disgust and loathing and fear, and as I am now, so you will be. Prepare yourself to follow me. And it's in a way beginning to see the whole way that the body is decaying and meditating on decay, so that you can find the place in you that has nothing to do with that by opening to that, because the denial of it keeps you stuck in it. That's the problem. Denial keeps you fixated. And that's why I wanted to get as close to the dying process as I possibly could. So the combination of the two things, one was that something had happened inside of me, which was a spiritual awakening that made death feel different. And the second was that I wanted to work on myself and be close to the deepest fear of incarnation, which was the fear of death. That combination led me to start in about 1963 to work with dying people and to want to be available to them. Now, what could I do? I wasn't a doctor. I wasn't a nurse. I really had very little. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an ordained priest. So the question what I could offer a human being was that I've purified the way to say it now over the years. What I have offered another human being is a spacious environment with my mind in which they can die as they need to die. I realize that I have no moral right to define how another person should die, that each individual has their own karma, their own stuff to work out. It's not my job to say, you should die beautifully or you should die this way. I don't even know why, how they should die. Let me give you an example of that. I was helping my stepmother die. She was 69 or so, and she had developed cancer. When she developed the cancer, she and I were good buddies, and my father was 18 years older than she was. And so I was, my role was to be with her and to help her through this process. And she and I went to the doctors together, and we did the whole thing of getting all of the reports and dealing with all the emotions. Now, she was a very tough New England lady. She was a wonderful, grounded, tough, poker-playing, smoking, just fun. She was argumentative and tough and willful. And she had this kind of stiff upper lip way of living life. And so she was doing that around her death. And my job wasn't to say, hey, Phyllis, you should open to this. That wasn't my moral, right? My job was just to be there with her. And I would lay on the bed and we'd hold each other and we'd just talk. And we'd talk about death and what we thought it might be like and all. But she was still very, very strong. But the pain of the cancer was very intense. And over time, it finally wore away her will. And there came a moment shortly before, maybe 4 or 5 days before her death, when she gave up. And now in our culture, giving up is seen as failure. Everybody says, you know, keep trying, keep trying. And we surround people that are dying with a certain kind of falseness that comes out of our own fear. When my mother, my natural mother, was dying, I remember it was back in 66, and she was in a hospital in Boston, and I would be sitting with her, and in those days I was taking a lot of psychedelics, so I'd usually be on something sitting with her. And I'd watch people come into the room, all the relatives and doctors and nurses saying, you're looking better, you're doing well. And then they go out of the room and say, she won't live the week. And I thought, how bizarre that a human being is going through one of the most profound transitions in their life and they're surrounded completely by deception. Can you hear the pain of that? That nobody could be straight with them because everybody was too frightened. Even the rabbi, all of them, everybody, everybody. And she and I talked about it, and she said, what do you think death is? I said, I don't know. I look at you, and you're my friend, and it looks like you're in a building that's burning down, but you're still there. And I figure when the building burns, it'll go, and you'll still be here. And in a way, we just met in that space. So Phyllis, she and I were, I was open, and she could ask whatever she wanted. I didn't say, now let me instruct you about dying, because she would have not accepted that. But then she gave up. And at the moment she surrendered, it was like watching an egg breaking and some being emerge that was so radiantly beautiful and present and light and joyful. It was a being that she, at some deep intuitive level, knew herself to be, but had never been busy being all of her adult life. And she opened to this being, and she and I just basked in its radiance. And she, at that moment, had gone into another plane of consciousness where we were completely together talking, being, but the pain and the dying process was just phenomena that were occurring. At that moment, she was no longer busy dying. She was just being, and dying was happening. And to tell you how extraordinary this, just to complete this story, right at the last moment, she said, Richard, sit me up, because I'm Richard to my family. She said, Richard, sit me up. So I sat her up. I put her legs over the bed and her body was falling forward, so I put my hand on her chest and her body fell back, so I put my other hand on the back and her head was lolling, so I put my head against her head. We were just sitting there together. And she took three breaths, slow, deep breaths, and she left. Now, if you read in the ancient Tibetan texts, the way in which conscious lamas leave their body, they sit up, they take three breaths, and they leave. Who was she? How did she know that? What was that about? I just want to play with you with the mysteries that I play with. Ramana Maharshi, who was a great Indian saint, was dying of cancer. And they said, let's treat it. And he said, no, it's time to drop this body. Because in India, it's called dropping the body. And you hear the implication of it, that there is something that drops the body. The body doesn't drop itself. The body is dropped. And his devotees started to cry. And they said, don't leave us, don't leave us. And he looked at them with confusion. He said, don't be silly. Where could I go? I'm just dying. Don't make such a big deal. It's like I'm just selling the Ford, you know. It's not such a big deal. I'm just dying. So the dying center, in my mind, was an institution where people like me, who wanted to be around people that were dying as part of their spiritual work on themselves, would create the support system, whether they were nurses or doctors or attendants or whatever. And the place would be open to people who wished to use their death as a vehicle for their own awakening. Because as you're going through these processes, for a person that really sees life's journey as a one of spiritual work on oneself, this is an optimum set of experiences to work with, the process of dying. So if you imagine now you have an institution in which everybody in the institution is there in order to spiritually awaken. They're called monasteries or ashrams. And it happens there are dyers and there are helpers of dyers there. But that's ground, not figure. The figure is the spiritual awakening. And everybody's there for the same reason. So you can hear, like, what I experience is that when I am with somebody like somebody, I work a lot with AIDS patients. Now here's a young person who very often is the object of social stigma. They're dealing with family rejection often. They're dealing with an opportunistic illness in which there are symptoms that are occurring in a jumbled mass, and you feel better and then you feel sick and then you hit here and then hit there. They're dealing with economic difficulties. When I come in to be with them, the first thing I have to do when I sit down with them is to open myself to all my reactions to their predicament. The minute I try to deny it, it catches me. So I have to open myself to it. So I have to open myself to my empathic reactions. That is, to me as a separate entity, feeling what it would feel like if I were being socially ostracized, had an opportunistic illness, was young, didn't have a chance to live out my dreams, all of it, all of the pain of it. It's only when Zalman gave me a beautiful line. I was interviewing him for television, a show, and I said, Zalman, if you were an Israeli, what would you say to a Palestinian? And Zalman said, oi. Oi, such a problem. He said, you know, he said, before we can be with one another, we have to learn to grieve with one another. We have to open ourselves to grieve for the other person's loss and pain. And when they feel heard in the grief, then we can start to meet behind the grief. And what I've learned is, whether I'm dealing in this, because I do a lot of work with political activists, and when I'm dealing with people of different ethnic origins and minority groups and all kinds of diversity, that I can always be my spiritual cuteness and up-level and say, we're all one. What are you so busy being black or, you know, Latino, Chicano, or whatever? They say, oh, that's not going to work. You're not hearing us. You are not hearing us. But if we sit with each other and grieve together, then we rise into the place of unity behind it. So when I sit with somebody, the first thing I have to do is open my heart as a separate entity to this other separate entity and go through the process of empathy. That's not compassion yet, that's empathy. Of as a separate entity feeling what they're feeling. And to be able to do that is interesting. To be able to keep your heart open in hell, really. To keep your heart open when it's breaking in a situation. To do that requires that you have cultivated the spiritual perspective behind it that allows for the wisdom of the universe, that allows for this is a little much to say, but it's true. It allows for the perfection that exists even within the imperfection. And once you are rooted in that understanding, if you have stood back, if you've been able to stand back enough to see the beauties of the laws of the universe, to see the exquisite intricacy of the unfolding of the spark of God manifesting into form, Shekhinah, if you see that, the brilliance of it, you are in awe. And at that point, the little mind that you have, which is just part of the manifestation, suddenly gets humble before that. And instead of saying, this is terrible, this suffering is awful, if I were doing it, I'd do it differently, you say, I really don't understand. But there's a place in me that has faith in the unfolding. And what has happened to me as a result of inner work, which I am talking about and commending to you, is that two planes of consciousness, living both with the perfection and with the pain of the suffering, allows you to stay with the pain without pushing it away, because you have the balance within yourself. It's as if you're part of the unity and you're also separate. You're part of the unfolding of all that includes suffering. Like with Phyllis, how am I to say now that the pain she went through that forced her to give up, that led to the spiritual awakening for her the few days before she died, I wouldn't have personally given her that pain, because I couldn't have done that. But am I to judge that as somehow wrong? And I'm faced with the paradox that I, as a human with a human emotional heart, want to take away your suffering. And at the same moment, there's another part of me that understands that suffering is grace. That suffering is the sandpaper from the spiritual point of view that is awakening people. And once you've started to spiritually awaken, you re-perceive your own suffering and start to work with it as a vehicle for awakening. Now, the interesting part of that paradox is you don't say to another person that says, oh, I'm suffering, you don't say, hey, it's grace. See? Because you have to give people space to do what they need to do. And if they're at the stage of their evolution where they see their suffering as this horrible thing that's being done to them, you can do the best you can to remove their suffering, the way they're experiencing their suffering. As my guru says, God comes to the hungry in the form of food. And you get what you need. So when I come in with somebody, let me give you an example. Woman, 42 years old, very wealthy, very beautiful, very talented, very creative, is dying of AIDS. And she comes to me several months before she's dying, and she said, Ram Dass, I wonder if you would help me die. I said, well, great, we'll do it together. So we started to meditate together, we started to talk, we started to read things and discuss them. And she said, I'd like to stay as conscious as I can through this process. Because you understand that the more you are aware of the spiritual nature of life, the more you see the moment of death as a moment for release, for taking off the tight shoe. And the art form in dying is that at the moment of death, you are neither grabbing at life nor pushing it away. You're neither pushing nor pulling. It's the attraction and aversion that keeps you holding to form. So to prepare for the moment of death, when the processes that go on in consciousness are a dissolving of boundaries, a speeding up of awareness, a kind of an opening and expanding, to be in that process where you don't go, no, and grab hold, one prepares. One prepares for the moment of death. And it's interesting that in almost all the Eastern traditions, people see one of the works of life is the preparation for the moment of death. Now, each person does what they can do. We don't make believe we're more ready than we are. So that I'm very pleased that we're getting to the point now where people can decide how much pain medication they need in collaboration with their doctor, rather than the nurse saying, you had it 4 hours ago, you can't have any more. Each person knows, and when they know they have control over their pain medication, they need a lot less, it turns out, because a lot of it is their fear of pain that they're dealing with. So with Mary, as I started to get to know her, she was an absolutely beautiful human being. Her family had ostracized her, and she had wonderful, many, many wonderful friends. And we started to be together in the hospital when she was finally in the hospital. We just sit and hold hands and look in one another's eyes. And what I then was able to do, see, after the first stage, when you empathize with the pain of another person, then comes the next stage where you start to meet the person behind it all. It's like, are you in there? I'm in here. Far out. What are you doing in there? Yeah. I mean, if I can just run you through this kind of oversimplified model. If you had a little television receiver channel right here, next to your eyes, what you're finding, what we're talking about is planes of consciousness or channels on a television set. And most of us, most of the time in this culture, act as if we have a one or two channel set. We don't have cable. And today we're talking about cable. We're talking about acknowledging all these other channels that are floating around in the room, but we're not picking them up because we don't know how to tune our receiver. That's basically what this is about. So on the first channel, when you look at another human being, you see old, young, dark, light, fat, thin, etc. You see physical body. And if you're obsessed with your physical body, that's what you see when you look in the world, other people's physical bodies. That's the channel you're on. If you flip one channel, then you're in the psychosocial realm. You see power and you see happiness and sadness and neurosis, and it's the therapy channel. It's the social role channel. It's where there are mothers and truck drivers and all lawyers and all the different roles and identities, all the social stuff. And that's all a channel, and that's as the world turns, and it's a never-ending source of fascination. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. Most people are happy with channel two. That's right. And channel one and two, about 98% of the people you've ever known are busy with those two channels all the time. But now we're talking about something else. We're talking about shifting. Now you shift one more channel, and there's a little in-between one, which is called, it's like the astral plane. It's where you're dealing with archetypes, the Jungian archetypes. You're dealing with what's called astral or mythic roles and mythic identities. It's that sort of place, where you see people in their mythos rather than in their personality structures. And that's where you see, and then you look at me and you say, he's an Aries, I just knew it. You know, it's a Sagittarius and Leos, and you see there's 12 of us in various permutations. If you flip to the next channel, you go behind all those individual differences and you just see another soul just like you that has all that packaging that's different than you but is just another being just like you. That's when you say, are you in there? I'm in here. How'd you get in that one? And you see all of the stuff of the personality and the astral and the mythic and the body and all of it as like packaging. And you see the spiritual individual entity. And just for fun, if you turn the channel once more, what it is you're looking, it's looking at itself, looking at itself. There's only one of it. It's awareness aware of itself. And just to keep the Buddhists happy, you turn it once more and it all disappears, which is basically the one in itself. It's basically the one in itself rather than looking at itself. Now, our predicament is that as long as you're on channel one and two, you are afraid of death. Until you are rooted in these other levels of reality, that gives you a perspective about death that allows you to see death as a transformation of things which change. You can intellectually know from channel one and two that after all, it's all nature and we are going to die, but that doesn't dissipate the fear. The fear comes from a gut intuitive knowing that comes from acknowledging these other parts of your being. And I say acknowledging. It's not learning them as if you're getting them from outside. It's acknowledging them from within yourself. And almost everybody has information about these all the time, but everybody's busy not having it. When you're too busy in channel one and two, you treat information from these other channels as if it's error in the system. It's static. I can't bring in the channel clearly, you know, somehow. I mean, it was interesting when I was a psychologist, which I guess I still am. When I was a research psychologist, the best we could do in predicting human behavior, psychological behavior, were correlations around 50 or 55, 60 when we were lucky. That's accounting for about 30% of the variability. That means 70% of the differences, the variability, we couldn't account for. And we said, well, that's just the fact that our tools aren't good enough yet. Or we called it error variance. Error variance includes karma. It includes all of the other planes of reality that explain who we are at this moment. And I just like to keep the door open for some of these things. Now, with Mary, when I opened to her, what happened was I've learned something about love, which is nice to learn about. And it's important to understand that in this dealing. First of all, most of our images of love in our society have to do with romantic love. They are poetic love. They are interpersonal love. I love you, you love me, we love each other. We all give lip service to, but hardly ever really acknowledge that there is another kind of love that is not interpersonal. We call it conscious love, or Christ's love, or God's love. And the image I have is that when you grow up in a society of conditional love, which most of us have grown up in because of the way in which we are socialized, we end up very needful for love. And that's why a lot of the literature is about love and affection. It's as if there's something in us that's very hungry. We're on a deprivation diet. And so when we meet somebody who has the key to unlock something in us, we experience that we are in love, and we say, I am in love with you. What we're really saying, another way of saying it in a kind of an instinct literature, is you are the key stimulus that is releasing the mechanism in me that allows. You are the key stimulus that is releasing the mechanism in me. You are the key stimulus that is releasing the mechanism in me that allows me to be in love. You're my connection. And as my connection, I want to possess you. Because I'm hungry to be in this state in my being. I have come into the place of love in my being. And everything is beautiful suddenly. But it only happens when you're around. So where will you be Thursday? And where will you be Friday? And where will you be for the rest of my life? See? And the tendency is to want to possess the beloved, which, as you and I both know, is one of the quickest ways to destroy the experience. And that love has in it fear, because somebody's going to die or go away or find another lover or something. Now, that's interpersonal romantic love. And that's why there's so much poetry about it, because it has the fear and the joy and all of the stuff in it. But now, take that image, that the key stimulus is something that opens you to the place in yourself where you are love. And through the spiritual practices, and through understanding the metaphysics, and through opening yourself, you find yourself starting, whether you call it awareness, where you draw your awareness back from thought, or however you get in there through meditation, through devotion, through study, whatever your practices are, you find yourself starting to rest in the place of presence in your being, which has the quality of that openness, that boundarylessness, that heart, intuitive heart space, where you experience that you are in love. But now you are no longer dependent on an external thing to awaken you to it. You're beginning to rest in it. So you are beginning to be love. Now the social problems that raise are very interesting, because what happens is now everyone you look at, you are in love with. And you don't quite know what to do, because if you've been working on an old deprivation model, you want to collect them all. So you get one and you say, let's nest. And you go back and you get twigs and drapes and, you know, make a nest. And then after some time you say, I'm going to the supermarket to get some tofu and beer. And and at the checkout counter, you look at the person at the checkout counter and it happens again. I mean, because now when the eyes, you see, are the windows to the soul, and the soul rests in love. The soul is a being within the place of love. So you look and there's your beloved. Now what are you going to do? You got one at home. So you say, have you considered a ménage à trois? But what are you going to do then? Are you going to not walk down the street and look at anybody? Because it's going to keep happening. And you realize that you're going to have to give up your deprivation model because there's an abundance of love. You're going to have to stop collecting it. And you're just going to start to go so that you pass your beloved on the street and you don't even wink. So you go through stages of, at first you can't believe it, see. So you go down the street and you meet one and you say, let's have coffee together. Or give me your telephone number, you know, in case I run out of the others later. I want to know that this one is, because it's so beautiful. And then after a while, you just keep letting go and letting go and letting go until you realize that isn't the way. You're just living in this presence of love. In which you, because the thing that has closed you down is the fear of the other person's pain and suffering. And once you have that spiritual perspective that allows you to keep your heart open in the hell and the pain and the grief and the stuff, then you can start to be in love with another human being without feeling the possessive quality about it. And so with Mary, I'm sitting with Mary and I am falling into love with her. And that is both levels, the person.